The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. Reading from SmithsonianMag.com. Smart News. Why does NOAA still send pilots into hurricanes? NOAA being the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The first Hurricane Hunter flight was a bet, but today they're an essential part of risk management. By Kat Eschner. On this day in 1943, an Air Force pilot flew into a hurricane to win a bet. His name was Colonel Joe Duckworth, and he was the first person to ever intentionally fly into a hurricane. But many have followed him since. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration keeps a fleet of airplanes specifically made for this purpose. To anyone who's ever been forced to flee from a hurricane, the practice might seem absurd. But it produces vital data that helps the government institution predict how bad a hurricane is likely to be and where it is going next. Duckworth did so in order to prove a point to the European pilots he was training, according to NOAA. A retired colleague of his recalled to the agency that Duckworth was training British pilots in the then innovative practice of instrument flying at Bryan Field in Galveston. Many of the British pilots were already aces from earlier battles over Europe, recalled Lieutenant Colonel Ralph O'Hare, Duckworth's co-pilot. They thought they should be learning in high-tech planes rather than training planes, and when it was announced that an extremely strong hurricane was heading their way, they mocked the planes for not being able to withstand what to them was just a strong wind. The problem was, few, if any, European had ever experienced a true hurricane, O'Hare remembered. Duckworth finally got tired of the heckling and made a bet with his trainees. He would fly right into the storm and out again, showing that both the plane and his instrument flying technique was sound. The trainees staked a cocktail on him, not being able to do it. Because this was a sketchy plan, Duckworth didn't tell his supervisors, but he managed to pull it off. He would later make the flight a second time, this time with the base weather officer on board, writes Engineering 360. Once Duckworth and his navigators were able to show that hurricane reconnaissance flights were possible, the beginning of modern-day hurricane hunting was born. Today, hurricane hunters fly specially equipped planes that NOAA described as high-flying meteorological stations. The data the planes and crew gather help forecasters make accurate predictions during a hurricane and help hurricane researchers achieve a better understanding of storm processes, improving their forecast models. As Duckworth knew, planes aren't usually destroyed by strong winds. Airliners routinely fly in jet streams with winds exceeding 150 miles per hour over the U.S. during the winter, writes NOAA. Hurricanes, which are large storms with circular wind patterns, can have winds as slow as 74 miles per hour. But though airplanes can withstand the trip to the eye of a hurricane, NOAA writes the process of flying in and out of the storm to record and examine pressure changes is grueling. Pilots fly missions of 8 to 10 hours, and as well as recording data, the flight crew needs to be on the lookout for any severe weather hotspots or shear, defined by NOAA as a sudden change in horizontal or vertical winds that can tear an airplane apart. History does not record whether Duckworth got his Victor's cocktail, but it's reasonable to assume he did enjoy it, with his feet on the ground. And there are two comments following that story. Thinking Man 2025 writes, "As one who has actually flown into hurricanes on a regular basis with NOAA, I can state unequivocally that the missions are not only still necessary, but the dangers of flying these storms with powerful aircraft like the WP-3D Orions NOAA uses is not all that great unless you're flying at very low altitudes. The hurricane boundary layer is quite turbulent. A hurricane undergoing rapid changes will give a rough ride on occasion, and if you fly above about 22,000 feet, the plane can be zapped by lightning, which sometimes results in pits on prop blades and or damage to radomes. But these things do not seriously threaten flight safety. None of these damaging effects occur at the typical flight altitudes from 5,000 to 10,000 feet. And Jay Glacklin writes, interesting to note that one of the most reliable hurricane chaser planes was the P-3 Orion, known in civil aviation as the Lockheed Electra 225. Due to a minor construction error, screws left a bit too long, Electra 225s used to lose wings under certain turbulence conditions. It destroyed the plane as a short-haul passenger carrier. After redesign, it created a sturdy plane still in service 50 years later. Our next story, before the Civil War, Congress was a hotbed of violence. A new book from historian Joanne Freeman chronicles the viciousness with which elected officials treated each other, by Anna Diamond. Scuffles seemed to break out in parliaments and legislatures around the world. The last few years saw a brawl in Taiwan, a face punch in Ukraine, and a mass fight in South Africa. The floor of the U.S. Congress is home today to plenty of verbal abuse and name-calling, but rarely sees anything physical. In her new book, Field of Blood, Joanne B. Freeman, Yale professor of history and American studies, finds that violence used to be the norm in the Capitol. Almost two centuries ago, when fists flew, pistols were drawn, and the threat of violence was all pervasive. She writes, the antebellum Congress had its admirable moments, but it wasn't an assembly of demigods. It was a human institution with very human failings. Bearing witness to those failings was Benjamin Brown French, a New Hampshire lawyer and editor who worked in Washington in the lead-up to the Civil War. During his four decades in our nation's capital, he crossed paths with presidents, learned the inner workings of politics, and journaled almost daily about the violence and tension he saw there. Freeman mined French's work to provide an insider's perspective of an increasingly contentious Congress. Freeman's book, Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War, is out on September 11. She spoke with Smithsonian about what antebellum Congress was really like. Who is our guide to Washington in your book? Benjamin Brown French came to Washington in 1830 and died there in 1870. And the entire time he was there, he was essentially either in Congress as a clerk or surrounded by congressmen. So he was the ideal witness for the world of the antebellum Congress. And in his diaries and in his letters to his brothers and sister, he had a gripping you-are-there way of understanding the culture and climate. At the beginning of my book, he's a very collegial fellow. People liked him, all parties, North and South. And by the end, he goes out to buy a gun in case he needs to shoot some Southerners. My question for the book was, how does a person begin thinking, I love my country, I shall do anything for the Union, I like everyone, everyone likes me, to, I better carry a gun in case some Southerners do something risky on the street to me? You write that he always seemed to be at the right place at the right time. What were some of the things that he witnessed? There was an assassination attempt against President Andrew Jackson that French saw happen. John Quincy Adams has a stroke after his presidency when he's serving in the House. He's pulled off the floor into a room off the House, and French is there by his side holding his hand. Most striking of all, when President Lincoln is assassinated, French is in the middle of it. By that point, he's in charge of, in essence, security in Washington. So he's running around trying to close buildings. He stands by Lincoln's side after he dies, while waiting for people to come and deal with the body. It's remarkable the degree to which events that we would consider the smash-bang highlight moments of this period. French doesn't necessarily play a central role in any of them, but he saw them, and even better, he wrote about them. What was Congress like in the decades leading up to the Civil War? The paintings from that time show senators in black frocks debating, their fingers thrust into the air in emphasis. But in truth, Congress was a violent place. This was in part because the nation was violent, too. There were riots in cities over immigration and fighting on the frontier over Native American land. The system of slavery was grounded in violence. It was not a kind era. A lot of people have heard of the caning of Charles Sumner in the Senate chamber in 1856, but you found many more examples. I found roughly 70 violent incidents in the 30 years before the Civil War, and very often the incidents featured a Southerner trying to intimidate a Northerner into compliance. It's all hidden between the lines in the congressional record. It might say, the conversation became unpleasantly personal. That meant dual challenges, shoving, pulling guns and knives. In 1858, South Carolina Representative Lawrence Keitt started trouble with Pennsylvania's Galusha Grow. It turned into a mass brawl between Southerners and Northerners in the House. How did voters feel about the violence? That changes over time, which isn't surprising, and it wasn't the same for everyone. There were certain people who were elected to Congress because they played rough. That's why their constituents sent them there, to play rough, to defend their interests with gusto. And that included sometimes threats and even also sometimes fists or weapons. People knew who they were electing to Congress, and they did it for a reason. The most striking example of that is, over time, increasingly confrontational Northerners getting sent to Congress. What role did the press play in the violence? Over time, it played a more central role as things like the railroad, the telegraph, the steam-powered printing press, and new ways of creating paper. There are all these technological innovations that makes the press bigger and faster and further reaching between the 1830s and the Civil War. What starts out as a pretty small press community in which congressmen knew who was sitting in the House and Senate recording things and often went and corrected the record, changes to all kinds of people from all over the country reporting in Congress, relying on the telegraph to be able to send their messages home. And congressmen don't have control of that spin. The press begins to play a more central, obvious role. Do you think this atmosphere helped push the country toward war? It fueled the progression. Southerners came to see Northerners as weak because they put up with the bullying. And if you're a Northerner in Congress, how do you say, I'm up for a compromise? You're going to look like a coward. The press played up the fighting, creating an endless loop of anger. This wasn't just about goofy guys in Washington. What goes on in Congress reflects the state of the nation. When writing the book, did you see similarities or differences to the tension in our contemporary Congress? Could this type of physical violence occur in Congress today? I have no idea whether it could happen in modern Congress, partly because who knows what's going to happen about anything at this point. To get to the point in modern day where you have physical violence, that would suggest such an extreme division on such a high level between people that they can't even really see themselves as playing on the same team at all. That would be meaningful and really worrying, I would say. Anna Diamond is the editorial assistant for Smithsonian Magazine. And the book, The Field of Blood, Joanne B. Freeman Recovers the Long-Lost Story of Physical Violence on the Floor of the U.S. Congress, is titled The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. Up next, why every food lover should visit the Twin Cities. Minnesota's Twin Cities are forging a new identity, one that celebrates the region's Nordic past while embracing its multicultural present, by Adam Sachs. Let's talk about the sweet potatoes at Young Joni, how they're blackened like campfire marshmallows, the insides all gooey and sweet, how they're spiked with gochugo and topped with barely there ruffles of bonito flakes, and underneath it all, clinging to the plate, an enlightened smear of crème fraîche and smoky charred scallions. Pardon my French. And sure, let's talk about how the mushrooms are freakishly juicy, water balloon juicy, because they're confited in olive oil before they hit the grill. Or how my favorite of Minnesota's embarrassment of lakes is the miniature one made of chestnut miso butter pooled beneath those plump mushrooms. We could talk this way about a lot of what's coming off the wood fire at this handsome Korean-ish pizza and other stuff restaurant in the artsy, low-slung Minneapolis neighborhood of Northeast. But I'm inclined not to belabor the thesaurus-taxing explications and dutiful prepositions of the professional food describer, this thing atop that one and a dollop of something else, and just say it directly. This stuff is really good. Get here and eat it if you can, even if that means strapping on a pair of cross-country skis and braving the whiteout of a freak spring blizzard, as it did for some undeterred young Joni devotees just before I visited in late April. I want you to walk in here and feel like the restaurant is giving you a big hug, said Ann Kim, chef proprietor of the 2-year-old establishment, which also runs Pizzeria Lola and Hello Pizza in southwest Minneapolis. Call it Korean Midwestern Hygge, H-Y-G-G-E. Call it the embrace of fire and spice by an often freezing city, newly hip to the multidimensional tastes of its increasingly diverse populace. Call it the embodiment of quirky cosmopolitan Minneapolis, St. Paul's ever so slightly showier younger sibling. Whatever it is, it's working. The place was packed to the wood-beamed rafters. Guests ordered the Amatriciana pizza, a meat-heavy pie called the YOLO, and another topped with fennel sausage, mozzarella, onion, and a dusting of fennel pollen. Kim grew up in the suburb of Apple Valley in the late 1970s when, it's fair to say, the full spectrum of the Asian pantry had not yet permeated the market or mind share of America's casserole belt. With her parents working, her grandmother ran and fed the household. Every November we'd help her make enough kimchi to last a year, Kim said. The only vessel we had that was big enough was our plastic kiddie pool. She'd let the cabbage brine in there, and then, in summer, my sister and I would clean out the pool and swim in it again. Another pizza served at Young Joni comes topped with arugula and Korean barbecue, which Kim served at Lola as a lark years ago. For some people, their first experience with Korean food is on top of a pizza pie. I love that. In 1850, the Swedish novelist Fredrika Bremer toured the territory that 8 years later would become a state and declared prophetically what a glorious new Scandinavia might not Minnesota become. And so, over the next century or so, it kind of did. Swedes and Danes and Norwegians joined Germans, Italians, and other settlers. The power of the St. Anthony Falls was harnessed, and the flour milling industry blossomed on the shores of the Mississippi River. Minneapolis and its next-door neighbor, St. Paul, grew large and prosperous, and everyone agreed, in their Midwestern, non-braggadocious way, that they were pretty nice places to live, if you didn't mind the winter. Hubert Humphrey and Walter Mondale's presence on the national stage gave the Twin Cities a reputation as a bastion of liberalism, even as they remained mostly white. But in more recent decades, the demographics have shifted. The Twin Cities have benefited from a transformative influx of immigrants from Mexico, Korea, and Vietnam, among others. Hmong refugees from Laos and Thailand began arriving in the mid-1970s. Today, there are thriving populations of Somalians, Liberians, and Ethiopians, and a dynamic South Asian community. The state's foreign-born population has more than doubled since the early 1990s. Seated at Young Joni's bar, I was joined by Cameron Gaynor, an artist and publisher of a literary arts and culture quarterly called The Third Rail. Gaynor came to town a decade ago from New York when his wife, Olga Vizo, took over as executive director of the Walker Arts Center. Back then, it was difficult to find anywhere to go after 8:30, Gaynor said. I'd tell people where we'd move, and they say, "Oh, Milwaukee's great." Now, he explained, living here feels like being at the center of something rapidly expanding and evolving, a vibrant creative class, a community of engaged artists, architects, and chefs, an American city like no other. Andrew Zimmerman, host of Bizarre Foods and outspoken booster of his adopted hometown, added to the list of reasons to love this place. Prince was from here. You can swim, sail, or canoe on our lakes on your lunch hour. We have the Minnesota State Fair, the single greatest party on planet Earth, and we've gone from not having a single oyster bar in town to being a national powerhouse as a restaurant city, all in one generation. The Twin Cities' pioneering cultural institutions have continued to reinvent themselves. The Walker, which was reclad and expanded in 2005 by Herzog and de Meuron, last year completed a lengthy overhaul of its iconic sculpture garden, adding 18 new works by artists such as Katharina Fritz and Theaster Gates. The 55-year-old Guthrie Theater unveiled a striking new Jean Nouvel designed home in 2006, with its endless bridge cantilevered out toward the Mississippi. St. Paul's Minnesota Museum of American Arts is in the midst of a massive expansion. Also last year, the century-old Minneapolis Institute of Art put on the first major exhibition of contemporary Somalian artwork. Artists have colonized the industrial buildings of northeast Minneapolis, converting the brick husks into studios and galleries. This dynamic cultural scene is by design. Minnesota ranks second in the nation after Washington, D.C., for per capita government spending on the arts. There's a let's make stuff vibe that's amazing, Gaynor said. There are opportunities to collaborate, to do things that don't exist yet, like start an art journal or open a Korean pizza joint. Give us one fried chicken sandwich as a garnish, please, Sammy Wadi said. We were wearing plastic bibs and burping frozen daiquiri slushies at Grand Catch, the bright and buoyant Asian-style Cajun seafood boil restaurant that he and his brother Syed just opened with their Tien Lai, Vietnamese chef, on St. Paul's leafy Grand Avenue. Sema, a Palestinian-American chef and restaurateur with a general air of mischievous merriment, was ordering lunch for the two of us. The sandwich, he emphasized, was a mere palate cleanser to be shared between the main events. Copious platters of pungently spiced crawfish, corn, gangly shrimp, and a Dungeness crab the size of a large chihuahua, whose keras base we'd lift and drink from as if it were a sacred chalice filled with the brothy crab inner delights. He met Thien Lai when a friend brought him to Cajun Deli, Lai's hole-in-the-wall seafood boil spot in suburban Brooklyn Park. For Sema, who'd opened and closed a Middle Eastern fine dining restaurant and moved on to run an eclectic street food truck and restaurant called World Street Kitchen, burritos with fried rice and curry chicken, shawarma tacos, everything's delicious and makes no sense. The border-bending Viet Cajun boil was a revolution. It burned my face, but it's so addicting, he said. Returning obsessively for years, he got to know Lai. Eventually, he and the Wadi brothers talked shop and decided to open one up. And here we were, bibbed and broth-spattered, drinking pink slushies in coupe glasses in this bright spot on a flush avenue. And there was a neon sign on the wall that read, What's Crackin'? And crab dip with fermented crab paste and Middle Eastern spices and an ice cream machine nicknamed Betty Lou that dispensed raspberry lychee soft serve to help cool the burn. I kept forgetting what state or country I was in and hoping I didn't have to leave. I wondered, were the Twin Cities ready for this 10 years ago? Absolutely not, Sammy said. 10 years ago, people weren't ready for my white tablecloth Middle Eastern restaurant with foie gras on the menu. Now people are just game. Now you can go to a Vietnamese restaurant and they're doing Minnesota walleye in clay pots. It's a gorgeous thing. And our final reading for today and for the month of August. America has been struggling with the metric system for almost 230 years. The United States is one of the world's only holdouts at this point, but it could have been the first country outside of France to adopt the system, by Kat Eschner. At press time, only three of the world's countries don't use the metric system, the United States, Myanmar, and Liberia. But it didn't have to be this way. In 1866, the Metric Act was passed by the Senate, The law, which was intended to authorize the use of the metric system of weights and measures, was signed by then-President Andrew Johnson the next day. It provided a table of standardized measurements for converting between metric and the commonly used American system that could be used for trade. The Metric Act doesn't require Americans to use the metric system, but it did legally recognize the then-relatively new system. It remains law, although it has been substantially amended over time to this day, writes the U.S. Metric Association. It was just the first in a number of measures leading to the United States' current system. Where metric is used for some things, like soda, drugs, and even military use, but not for other things. Americans' body weight scales, recipes, and road signs, among other examples of everyday use, haven't converted, writes Victoria Clayton for The Atlantic, and neither has the country's educational system. This split system exists for reasons, but arguments about how to create a good national standard of measurement go all the way back to 1790. The USMA is one of a number of voices advocating for America's full metrification. It argues that converting to the International System of Units, the modern form of the metric system, abbreviated as SI, would make international trade simpler. Technically, the American system, known as Imperial, is called United States Customary Units, or USCS. It also argues that the decimalized metric system is simpler to work with. SI units influence the size of packages, such as 750 milliliter bottles of wine, as well as how the package must be labeled. Since 1994, both metric and USCS have been required on commercial packaging. The United States is metric, at least more metric than most of us realize. American manufacturers have put out all metric cars, and the wine and spirits industry abandoned fifths for 75 milliliter bottles. The metric system is quietly and behind the scenes now the standard in most industries, with a few notable exceptions like construction. Its use in public life is also on the uptick, as anyone who has run a 5K can tell you. America has been creeping towards metrification almost since the country was founded. In 1790, the United States was ripe for conversion, writes David Owen for The New Yorker. At the time, the metric system was a new French invention, and adopting a system that departed from the old world conventions was based on modern decimalized units. It seemed like a good fit for the United States. The French and Americans had supported and conflicted with one another over the revolutions in statehood, and there was some expectation on the part of the French that the country would join them in the measurement revolution as well. But even though the government was shopping for a uniform system of weights and measures, Owen writes, the meter was too new and too French. Then Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson originally advocated for the meter, but then discarded the idea. And that wraps up our time for today. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.